you lived through it, you already know there are no words that will ever come close to describing it. And if you didn't, you will never understand.
Part 3. A quote from Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank. How wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world. He was faster than me, and stronger. When he finally caught me, he clamped a hand around my mouth so that I couldn't scream and dragged me into an abandoned barn, where he tossed me down in a dusty bed of hay. I stared up at him, wondering who he really was, how I hadn't seen it. "Will you kill me, too?" I challenged. "No," Alex said quietly. "I'm doing what I can to save you." He reached through the broken glass of the window to scoop a handful of snow. Rubbing it into his arms, he then wiped himself dry with the shreds of his shirt. It was easy to see the fresh wounds on his shoulders and chest and back. But there were at least a dozen others, narrow cuts that ran down the inside of his arm, over his wrist, into his palm. "After he attacked you, I started doing it," Alex said, "baking the bread."
"I don't understand."
In the moonlight, the scars on his arm were a silver ladder.
"I didn't ask to be who I am," he said tightly. "I try to keep Casimir locked up and hidden. I feed him raw meat, but he's always hungry. I do what I can to keep him from letting his nature win. I try to keep a rein on it myself, too. Most of the time I can. But one day he got away when I was out trying to find him food. I tracked him into the woods. He had gone after your father, who was cutting wood for the oven, but your father had the advantage of an axe. When I ran in, trying to distract Casimir, it gave your father a chance to fight back. He managed to land a blow to Casimir's thigh. I went to grab the axe away. I don't know if it was the smell of the blood or the adrenaline in his system."
Alex looked away.
"I don't know why it happened, why I couldn't control myself. He is still my brother. That's my only excuse."
Alex raked his hand through his hair, making it stand like a rooster's comb.
"I knew if it happened again, even once, it would be too much. I had to find a way to protect others just in case. So I asked to work for you."
I looked at his scars, and I thought of the role he had been baking me each day, the way he begged me to eat it all. I thought of the baguettes that I had sold this week, the customers who told me that the mere taste of them was a religious experience. I thought of old Sal, saying that the only way to be immune to an oupure was to consume its blood. I thought of the rosy tint to the dough, and I understood what Alex was telling me. He was literally bleeding himself dry to save us all from himself.
Sage. My grandmother was a survivor two times over. Long before I knew she had any connection to the Holocaust, she battled cancer. I was tiny, maybe 3 or 4. My sisters were in school during the day, but my mother took me to Nana's house every morning when my grandfather left for work, so that she would not be alone during her recovery. My grandmother had a radical mastectomy. During her recuperation, she would lie on the couch while I watched Sesame Street and colored at the coffee table in front of her, and my mom cleaned and did her dishes and cooked her meals. Every hour she would do her exercises, which consisted of crawling her fingers up the wall behind the couch and stretching as high as she could, a way to rebuild the muscles damaged by the surgery. Each morning after we arrived, my mother would help Nana into the bathroom for her shower. She would close the door and unzip my grandmother's housecoat, and then she would let my grandmother rinse herself off under the steaming water. 15 minutes later, she would knock softly and enter again, and the two of them would come out, Nana smelling of talcum powder, dressed in a fresh housecoat, and the hair at her nape damp but the rest of it mysteriously dry. One day, after my mother got Nana settled in her shower, she went upstairs with a stack of folded laundry. "Sage," she told me, Stay here until I come back. I didn't even turn away from the television. Oscar the Grouch was on, and I was scared of Oscar. If I looked away, he could sneak out of his garbage can when I wasn't looking. But as soon as my mother was out of sight and Oscar was off screen, I wandered to the bathroom. The door was unlatched so that my mother would be able to get in. I pushed it open just a crack and immediately felt my hair curl as the steam surrounded me. I couldn't see at first. It was as if I'd walked into a cloud. But then, when my vision cleared, I noticed my grandmother on the other side of the shower glass, sitting on a little plastic stool. She had turned off the water, but on her head was a shower cap that looked like a cartoon mushroom, red with white dots. Draped over her lap was her towel. With her good hand, she was patting powder on her body. I had never seen her naked. I had never seen my mother naked, for that matter. So I stared, because there were so many differences between her body and mine. The skin, for one, which sagged at her knees and her elbows and belly, as if there wasn't enough to fill it. The whiteness of her thighs, as if she never ran around outside in shorts, which was probably true. The number on her arm, which reminded me of the ones that the grocery clerk scanned when we were buying food. And, of course, the scar where her left breast had been. Still angry and red, the puckered flesh covered a cliff, a sheer wall. By then my grandmother had seen me. She opened the shower door with her right hand so that I nearly choked from the smell of talcum. "Come closer, Sejale," she said. "There's nothing about me I want to hide from you." I took a step forward, and then I stopped, because the scars on my Nana were much scarier, even, than Oscar. "You notice something's different about me," my grandmother said. I nodded. I did not have the words at that age to explain what I wasn't seeing, but I understood that it was not what should have been. I pointed to the wound. "It's missing," I said. My grandmother smiled, and that was all it took for me to stop seeing the scar and to recognize her again. "Yes," she said. "But see how much of me is left." I wait in my Nana's room while Daisy gets her ready for bed. With tenderness, her caretaker stacks her pillows the way she likes and tucks her into the covers before retiring for the night. I sit down on the edge of the bed and hold my grandmother's hand, which is cool and dry to the touch. I don't know what to say. I don't know what there is left to say. The skin on my face tingles, as if scars can recognize each other, even though the ones my grandmother has revealed this time have been invisible. I want to thank her for telling me. I want to thank her for surviving, because without her, I wouldn't be here to listen. But like she said, sometimes words are not big enough to contain all the feelings you are trying to pour into them. My grandmother's free hand dances over the edge of the sheet, pulling it up to her chin. "When the war ended," she says, "this was what took getting used to. The comfort. I couldn't sleep on a mattress for a long time. I'd take a blanket and sleep on the floor instead." She looks up at me, and for a second, I can see the girl she used to be. "It was your grandfather who set me straight. Minka," he said, "I love you, but I'm not sleeping on the ground." I remember my grandfather as a soft-spoken man who loved books. His fingers were always stained with ink from receipts he would write customers at his antiquarian bookstore. "You met in Sweden," I say, which is the story we had all been told. She nods.
"After I recovered from typhus, I went there. We survivors could travel anywhere in Europe then for free. I went with some other women to a boarding house in Stockholm, and every day I ate breakfast in a restaurant, just because I could. He was a soldier on leave. He said he had never seen a girl eat so many pancakes in his life."
A smile creases her face.
"He came every day to that restaurant and sat next to me at the counter until I agreed to let him take me out to dinner."
"You swept him off his feet." My grandmother laughs.
"Hardly. I was all bones. No breasts, no curves, nothing. I had hair that was only an inch long all over my head. The best style I could fashion after the lice were gone. I barely looked like a girl, she says. On that first date, I asked him what he saw in me. And he said, my future. Suddenly, I remember being young and taking a walk around the neighborhood with my sisters and my grandmother. I hadn't wanted to go. I was reading a book, and strolling without a destination in mind seemed pointless. But my mother pressured all three of us girls, and so we traipsed at my grandmother's snail pace around the block. She was horrified when we wanted to dart down the middle of the street. "Why stay in the gutter?" she said, "when you have this fine sidewalk." I thought at the time she was being overly cautious, worried about cars on a residential street that never saw any traffic. Now I realize she could not comprehend why we wouldn't use the sidewalk simply because we could. When a freedom is taken away from you, I suppose, you recognize it as a privilege, not a right. When we first got to America, your grandfather suggested I join a group with others who were like me, who'd been, you know, in the camps. I dragged him with me. We went to 3 meetings. Everyone there talked about what had happened and how much they hated the Germans. I didn't want that. I was in a beautiful new country. I wanted to talk about movies and my handsome husband and my new friends. So I left, and instead I went on with my life. After what the Germans did to you, how could you forgive them? Saying the word out loud makes me think of Joseph. Who says that I did? My grandmother replies, surprised. I could never forgive the Schutzhaftlagerführer for killing my best friend. I don't blame you. No, Sage, I mean I couldn't, literally, because it is not my place to forgive him. That could only be done by Daria, and he made that impossible. But by the same logic, I should be able to forgive the Hauptscharführer. He broke my jaw, but he also saved my life. She shakes her head. And yet, I can't. She is quiet for so long that at first I think she has fallen asleep. When I was in that starvation cell, my grandmother says quietly, I hated him, not for fooling me into trusting him or even for beating me, but because he made me lose the compassion I had for the enemy. I no longer thought of Herr Bauer or Herr Fassbinder. I believed one German was the same as any other, and I hated them all. She looks at me, which means, for that moment, I was no better than any of them. Leo sees me close the bedroom door behind me after my grandmother falls asleep. You okay? I notice he has cleaned up the kitchen, rinsed out the glasses we used for our tea, swept the table clear of crumbs, washed down the counter. She's asleep now, I reply, not really answering his question. How can I? How could anyone be okay after hearing what we've heard today? And Daisy's here if she needs anything. Look, I know how hard it must be to hear something like that. You don't know, I interrupt. You do this for a living, Leo, but it's not personal for you. Actually, it's very personal, he says, and immediately I feel guilty. He's dedicated his whole life to finding the people who perpetrated these crimes. I didn't care enough to push my grandmother to open up to me, even as a teenager, when I found out that she was a survivor. He's Rainer Hartmann, isn't he? I ask. Leo turns off the lights in the kitchen. Well, he says, we'll see. What aren't you telling me? He smiles faintly. I'm a federal agent. If I told you, I'd have to kill you. Really? No.
He holds the door open for me and then makes sure it is locked behind us. All we know right now is that your grandmother was at Auschwitz. There were hundreds of SS officers there. She still hasn't identified your Joseph as one of them. He's not my Joseph, I say. Leo opens the passenger door of his rental car for me, then walks around to the driver's side. I know you have a vested interest in this, and I know you want it finished yesterday. But in order for my department to follow through, we have to dot all the I's and cross all the T's. While you were in there with your grandmother, I called one of my historians in Washington. Ginevra's working up an array of photographs and FedExing it to me at the hotel. With any luck tomorrow, if your grandmother's up to it, we could have the proof we need to get this ball rolling. He pulls out of the driveway. But Joseph confessed to me, I argue. Exactly. He didn't want to be extradited or prosecuted, or he would have confessed to me. We don't know what his agenda is, if this is some delusion he's harboring, or if he just has a weird death wish. There are a dozen reasons he might want you to take part in an assisted suicide, and maybe he thinks he has to make himself seem reprehensible before you'll consider it. I don't know. But all those details. He's in his 90s. He could have been watching the History Channel for the past 50 years. There are a lot of experts on World War II. Details are good, but only if they can be pinned down to a particular individual. Which is why, if we can corroborate his story with an eyewitness who actually saw him at Auschwitz, we suddenly have a case. I fold my arms across my chest. Things move much quicker on Law and Order SVU. That's because Mariska Hargitay's contract's up for renewal, Leo says. Look, the first time I listened to a survivor's testimony, I felt the same way. And it wasn't my own grandmother. I wanted to kill all the Nazis, even the ones who are already dead. I wipe my eyes, embarrassed to be crying in front of him. I can't even imagine some of the things she told us. I've heard them a few hundred times, Leo says softly, and it doesn't get any easier. So we just go home now? Leo nods. Get a good night's sleep and wait for my package to get here. Then we can visit your grandmother again and hope she's up to making an ID. And if she does, who are we helping? Not my grandmother, that's for sure. She has spent years reinventing herself so that she isn't a victim anymore. But aren't we redefining her as one if we ask her for that ID? I think of Joseph or Reiner or whatever his name used to be. Everyone has a story. Everyone hides his past as a means of self-preservation. Some just do it better or more thoroughly than others. But how can anyone exist in a world where nobody is who he seems to be? Silence grows between us, filling all the empty space in the rental car. I jump when the GPS tells us to turn right, onto the highway. Leo fumbles with the radio. Maybe we should listen to some music. He winces as rock fills the car. Too bad we don't have any CDs, I say. I don't know how to work one of those things anyway. I don't have one in my car. A CD player? Are you kidding? What do you drive, a Model T? I have a Subaru. It just happens to have an 8-track. They still exist? Don't judge. I'm a vintage kind of guy. So you like oldies, I say, intrigued. The Shirelles and the Trogs, Jan and Dean. Whoa, Leo says. Those aren't oldies. Cab Calloway, Billie Holiday, Peggy Lee, Woody Herman. I'm about to blow your mind, I reply, and I tune the radio to a new station. As Rosemary Clooney croons to us, Leo's eyes widen. This is incredible, he says. Is it a Boston station? It's Sirius XM, satellite radio. Pretty nifty technology. In related news, they also now make movies that talk. Leo smirks. I know what satellite radio is. I just never figured it was worth listening to. Isn't it kind of dangerous to live in the past? No more dangerous than living in the present and realizing nothing's changed, Leo says. That makes me think of my grandmother again. She said that's why she didn't want to talk about what happened to her, that there didn't seem to be much of a point. I don't entirely believe her, Leo says. Watching history repeat might be self-defeating, but there's usually another reason that survivors keep their experiences to themselves. Like? To protect their families. It's PTSD, really. Someone who's been traumatized like that can't switch off some emotions and leave others intact. Survivors who look perfectly fine on the outside can still be emotionally empty at the core. And because of that, they can't always connect with their kids or their spouses. Or they make the conscious decision not to connect, so that they don't fail the people they love. They're afraid of passing on the nightmares or of getting attached and losing someone again. But as a result of that, their kids grow up and model that behavior with their own families. I try, but can't remember my father being distant. He did, however, keep my grandmother's secrets for her. Had my Nana tried to spare him by staying silent, and had he suffered anyway? Did that emotional disconnection skip a generation? I screened my face from people. I found a job that allowed me to work nights, alone. I let myself fall for a man I knew was never going to be mine, because I did not think I'd ever be lucky enough to find someone to love me forever. Had I been hiding because I was a freak? Or was I a freak because I'd been hiding? Was my scar only part of it? The trigger for trauma, passed down through the bloodline? I don't realize I'm sobbing until the car suddenly swerves across three lanes and Leo gets off at an exit. I'm sorry, he says, pulling to the curb. A reflection from the rearview mirror boxes his eyes. That was a stupid thing to say. For the record, it doesn't always happen that way. Look at you, you turned out perfectly fine. You don't know me. But I'd like to. Leo's answer seems to shock him as much as it shocks me. I bet you say that to all the girls who are crying hysterically. Ah, you figured out my M.O. He hands me a handkerchief. Who still carries a handkerchief? A guy who has an 8-track in his car, I suppose. I wipe my eyes and blow my nose, then tuck the little square into my pocket. I'm 25 years old, I say. I got laid off from my job. My only friend is a former Nazi. My mother died 3 years ago, and it feels like it was yesterday. I have nothing in common with my sisters. The last relationship I had was with a married man. I'm a loner. I'd rather have a root canal than have my photo taken. I say, crying so hard I am hiccuping. I don't even have a pet. Leo tilts his head. Not even a goldfish? I shake my head. Well, lots of people lose their jobs, Leo says. Your friendship with a Nazi could lead to the deportation or extradition of a war criminal. I'd think that would give you something to chat about with your sisters. And I also bet it would make your mother proud, wherever she is now. Photos are so airbrushed these days you can't trust what you see anyway. And as for you being a loner, he adds, you seem to have no trouble having a conversation with me. I consider this for a moment. You know what you need? A reality check? Leo puts the car in gear. Perspective, he says. The hell with going home. I've got a better idea. I remember thinking, as a kid, that churches were so incredibly beautiful, with their stained glass windows and stone altars, their vaulted ceilings and polished pews. In contrast, the temple, where I was dragged for my sister's bat mitzvahs a full hour's ride away, was downright homely. Its roof came to a massive brown metal point, some sort of abstract ironwork, probably meant to be a burning bush, but it looked more like barbed wire, decorated the lobby. The color scheme was aqua, orange, and burnt sienna, as if the 1970s had projectile vomited all over the walls. Now, as Leo holds the door open for me so I can walk inside, I decide that either Jews must be universally bad interior decorators, or all temples were built in 1972. The doors to the sanctuary are closed, but I can hear music seeping out from beneath them. "Looks like they've already started," Leo says,
but that's okay. You're taking me on a date to Friday night services? This is a date? Leo replies. Are you one of those people who looks up the nearest hospital before you travel, except it's not a hospital you scout out, but a temple? No, I was here once before. I had a case once that involved the testimony of a guy who had been part of a Sonderkommando. When he died a few years later, a contingent from my office came to the funeral here. I knew we couldn't be too far away. I told you, religion isn't really my thing. Duly noted, he says, and he grabs my hand, cracks open the sanctuary door, and pulls me inside. We slip into the last pew on the left. Up on the bima, the rabbi is welcoming the congregation and telling them how good it is to worship with everyone. He begins to read a prayer in Hebrew. I think back to the moment I lobbied my parents to stop going to temple. Sweat breaks out on my forehead. I think I'm having a flashback. Leo's hand closes around mine. Just give it a chance, he whispers. He doesn't let go. When you do not understand the language being spoken, you have two options. You can struggle against the isolation, or you can give yourself up to it. I let the prayers roll over me like steam. I watch the congregation when it is their turn for responsive reading, like actors who've memorized their cues. When the cantor steps forward and sings, the music is the melody of sorrow and regret. It suddenly hits me. These words, they are the same words my grandmother grew up with. These notes, they are the same notes she listened to. And all of these people, the elderly couples and the families with small children, the preteens waiting on their bar and bat mitzvahs, and the parents who are so proud of them that they cannot stop touching their hair, their shoulders. They would not be here if things had gone the way Rainer Hartmann and the rest of the Nazi regime had planned. History isn't about dates and places and wars. It's about the people who fill the spaces between them. There is a prayer for the sick and the healing, a sermon from the rabbi. There is a blessing over challah and wine. Then it is time for the Kaddish. The prayer for loved ones who've died. I feel Leo get to his feet beside me.
Yiskadal v'yiskadash shomei Rabo.
Reaching down, Leo pulls me up, too. Immediately I panic, sure that everyone is staring at me, a girl who doesn't know the lines of the play she's been cast in. Just repeat after me, Leo whispers. And so I do, unfamiliar syllables that feel like pebbles I can tuck into the corners of my mouth. Amen, Leo says finally. I don't believe in God, but sitting there, in a room full of those who feel otherwise, I realize that I do believe in people, in their strength to help each other and to thrive in spite of the odds. I believe that the extraordinary trumps the ordinary any day. I believe that having something to hope for, even if it's just a better tomorrow, is the most powerful drug on this planet. The rabbi gives the closing prayer, and when he lifts his face to the congregation, it is clear and renewed, the surface of a lake at dawn. If I'm going to be honest, I feel a little like that myself, like I've turned the page, found a fresh start.
Shabbat shalom, the rabbi says.
The woman sitting next to me, who is about the same age as my mother, and who sports a gravity-defying spiral of cherry-red hair, smiles so widely I can see her fillings.
Shabbat shalom, she says, clasping my hand tightly, as if she has known me forever.
A little boy in front of us, who has been wiggling most of the time, bounces onto his knees and holds out his chubby starfish fingers, a toddler's high five. His father laughs.
What do you say? He prompts. Shabbat?
The boy buries his face in his father's sleeve, suddenly shy.
Next time,
the man says, grinning. All around us the same words are being spoken, like a ribbon that sews its way through a crowd, a drawstring pulling everyone together. As people begin to drift away, milling into the lobby where Oneg Shabbat, tea and cookies and conversation, has been set up, I stand.
Leo, however, doesn't. He is gazing around the room with an expression on his face I cannot quite place. Wistfulness, maybe. Pride. Finally, he looks at me. "This," he says, "this is why I do what I do." At the Oneg Shabbat, Leo brings me iced tea in a plastic cup and arugula that I politely decline, because it's clearly store-bought and I know I could do better. He calls me a pastry snob, and we are still laughing about that when an older couple approaches. I start to turn away, instinctively trying to conceal the bad half of my face, but a sudden thought of my grandmother flashes through my mind, explaining her mastectomy scars years ago, and today, her memories of the Holocaust. But see how much of me is left? I lift my chin and directly face the couple, daring them to comment on my rippled skin. But they don't. They ask us if we're new in town. "Just passing through," Leo tells them. "It's a nice community for settling down," the woman says. "So many young families." Clearly, they assume we're a couple. "Oh, we're not... I mean, he isn't..." "What she's trying to say is that we're not married," Leo finishes. "Not for long," the man says. "Finishing her sentences, that's the first step." Twice more we are approached and asked if we've just moved here. The first time Leo says that we were going to go to the movies, but nothing was playing so we came to Temple instead. The second time he replies that he is a federal agent and I'm helping him crack a case. The man who's been chatting with us laughs. "Good one," he says. "You'd be surprised how hard it is to get people to believe the truth," Leo tells me later as we walk across the parking lot. But I'm not surprised. Look at how hard I fought Joseph when he tried to tell me who he used to be. I guess that's because most of the time we don't want to admit it to ourselves. "That's true," Leo says thoughtfully. "It's amazing what you can convince yourself of if you buy into the lie. You can believe, for example, that a dead-end job is a career. You can blame your ugliness for keeping people at bay, when in reality you're crippled by the thought of letting another person close enough to potentially scar you even more deeply. You can tell yourself that it's safer to love someone who will never really love you back, because you can't lose someone you never had. Maybe it's because Leo is a professional keeper of secrets. Maybe it's because I've been so emotionally bruised today. Maybe it's just because he listens more carefully than anyone else I've ever met. For whatever reason, I find myself telling him things I've never before admitted out loud. As we drive north again, I talk about how I was always an outsider, even in the confines of my family. I tell him that I worry my parents died, wondering if I'd ever be able to support myself. I admit that when my sisters come to visit, I tune out their talk of carpools and Moroccan oil treatments and what Dr. Oz has to say about colon health. I tell him that once I went for a whole week without speaking a word, just to see if I could, and if I would recognize my voice when I finally did. I tell him that the moment bread comes out of the oven, when I hear each loaf crackle and sing as it hits the cool air, is the closest I've come to believing in God. It is nearly 11 o'clock when we pull into Westerbrook, but I'm not tired. "Coffee?" I suggest. "There's a great place in town that stays open till midnight." "If I drink coffee now, I'll be bouncing off the ceiling till dawn," Leo says. I look down at my hands in my lap, feeling impossibly naive. Someone other than me would have been able to pick up on social cues, would know that this camaraderie between us is forced by the case Leo's investigating, and not an actual friendship. "But," he adds, "maybe they have herbal tea?" Westerbrook is a sleepy town, so there are only a handful of people in the cafe, even though it's a Friday night. A girl with purple hair who is absorbed in a volume of Proust looks annoyed when we interrupt her to place an order. "I'd make a snide comment about the youth of America," Leo says after he insists on paying for my latte, "but I'm too impressed by the fact that she's reading something other than 50 Shades of Grey." Maybe this will be the generation that saves the world, I say. Doesn't every generation think they'll be the one to do it? Did mine? Or were we so wrapped up in ourselves that we didn't think to look for answers in the experiences of others? I had known what the Holocaust was, of course, but even after learning my grandmother was a survivor, I had studiously avoided asking questions. Was I too apathetic, or too terrified, to think such ancient history had anything to do with my present or my future? Did Joseph's? By his own account, he had believed, as a boy, that a world without Jews would be a better place. So does he see the outcome now as a failure, or as a bullet that was dodged? I keep wondering which is the real him, I murmur. The man who wrote college recommendations for hundreds of kids and who cheered a baseball team to the state playoffs and who shares his role with his dog, or the one my grandmother described. It might not be an either-or, Leo says. It could be both. Then did he have to lose his conscience to do what he did in the camps, or did he never have one? Does it even matter, Sage? He clearly has no sense of right and wrong. If he did, he would have turned down the orders to commit murder. And if he committed murder, he could never develop a conscience afterward because it would be suspect, like finding God on your hospital deathbed. So what if he was a saint for the past 70 years? That doesn't bring back to life the people he killed. He knows that, or he wouldn't have bothered to ask you for forgiveness. He feels like there's still a stain on him. Leo leans forward. You know, in Judaism, there are two wrongs that can't be forgiven. The first is murder, because you have to actually go to the wronged party and plead your case, and obviously you can't if the victim is 6 feet underground. But the second unforgivable wrong is ruining someone's reputation. Just like a dead person can't forgive the murderer, a good reputation can't ever be reclaimed. During the Holocaust, Jews were killed and their reputation was destroyed. So no matter how much Joseph repents for what he did, he's really striking out on two counts. Then why try? I ask. Why would he spend 70 years doing good deeds and giving back to his community? That's easy, Leo says. Guilt. But if you feel guilty, that means you have a conscience, I point out. And you just said that's impossible for Joseph. Leo's eyes light up at our verbal sparring. You are far too smart for me, but only because it's past my bedtime. He keeps talking, but I don't hear him. I don't hear anything, because suddenly the door of the cafe opens and in walks Adam, with his arm around his wife. Shannon's head is bent close to his, and she is laughing at something he's just said. One morning, when we were tangled in the sheets of my bed, Adam and I had tried to top each other by telling the worst joke ever. What's green and has wheels? Grass. I lied about the wheels. What's red and smells like blue paint? Red paint. A duck walks into a bar and the bartender asks, "What'll it be?" The duck doesn't answer because it's a duck. Have you seen Stevie Wonder's new house? Well, it's really nice. So, a seal walks into a club. How do you make a clown cry? You kill his family. What do you call a man with no arms and no legs who is on your doorstep? Whatever his name happens to be. We had laughed so hard that I started to sob, and I couldn't stop, and I think it had nothing to do with the jokes. Did he just tell Shannon one of those one-liners? Maybe a joke I'd told him? This is only the third time I've seen Shannon in person, the first without a great distance or a pane of glass between us. She is one of those effortlessly pretty women, like the Ralph Lauren models, who don't need makeup and who have all the right streaks in their blonde hair and who can wear an untucked shirt and have it be a fashion choice instead of sloppiness. Without really thinking about what I'm doing, I slide my chair closer to Leo's. Sage? Adam says. I don't know how he can speak my name without his face becoming flushed, I wonder if his heart is racing like mine is, and if his wife notices. Oh, I reply, trying to act surprised. Hey. Shannon, this is Sage Singer. Her family was one of our clients. Sage, this is my wife. I feel sick to my stomach at his description of me. But then again, what would I have expected him to say? Adam's eyes flicker to Leo, waiting for an introduction. I slip my arm through his. To his credit, he doesn't look at me like I've just lost my mind. This is Leo Stein. Leo holds out his hand to shake Adam's, and then his wife's. Pleasure. Just saw the new Tom Cruise film, Adam says. Have you seen it? Not yet, Leo replies. I have to stifle a smile. Leo probably thinks the new Tom Cruise film is risky business. It was a compromise, Shannon says. Guns and aliens for him and Tom Cruise for me. But then again, I would have watched paint dry if it meant getting a sitter and leaving the house. She's smiling, never breaking eye contact, as if she's trying to prove to both of us that my scar doesn't bother her in the least. I don't have kids, I say. I never really had your husband, either. Leo puts his arm around my shoulders and squeezes. Yet. My jaw drops. When I turn to him, a smile twitches at the corners of his mouth. How did you say you know Sage again? He asks Adam. Business, we say in unison. Would you two like to join us? Leo asks. No, I quickly reply. I mean, weren't we just leaving? Taking my cue, Leo stands up, grinning. You know Sage. She doesn't like to be kept waiting, if you know what I mean. Putting his arm around my waist, he says his goodbyes and leads me out of the cafe. As soon as we've turned the corner, I light into him. What the hell was that? From your reaction, I'm assuming it was the boyfriend you told me you didn't have, and his wife. You made it sound like I'm a sex fiend, like we, you and me, are sleeping together. Isn't that what you wanted him to think? I bury my face in my hands. I don't know what I want him to think. Is he a cop? I'm getting that vibe. He's a funeral director, I say. I met him when my mother died. Leo's brows shoot up to his hairline. Wow, my gut instinct was way off there. I watch the usual interplay of emotions across his face as he connects the dots. This man touches dead bodies. This man touched me. It's just a job, I point out. It's not like you go and reenact the Allied victory in the bedroom. How would you know? I do a mean Eisenhower impression. Leo stops walking. For what it's worth, I'm sorry. I guess it's a pretty big shock to find out that a guy you were involved with is married. I already knew, I confess. Leo shakes his head as if he can't quite figure out how to say what he needs to. I can tell he's biting his tongue. None of my business, he says finally, walking briskly to the car. He's right. It's none of his business. He doesn't know what love is like for someone who looks like me. I have three options. One, be sad and lonely. Two, be the woman who is cheated on. Three, be the other woman. Hey, I shout, catching up to him. You have no right to judge me. You know nothing about me. Actually, I know a lot about you, Leo counters. I know that you're brave. Brave enough to call my office and open a can of worms that could have stayed shut your whole life. I know that you love your grandma. I know that your heart is so big you're struggling with whether or not you can forgive a guy who's done something unforgivable. You're pretty remarkable in a lot of ways, Sage, so you'll have to excuse me if I'm a little disappointed to find out that you're not quite as bright and shiny as I thought you were. And you? Have you never done anything wrong in your life? I argue. No,
I've done plenty wrong, but I didn't go back and do it again. I don't know why seeing Leo disillusioned feels even worse than running into Adam and Shannon. We're not together, I explain. It's complicated. Do you still love him? Leo asks. I open my mouth, but nothing comes out. I love feeling loved. I don't love knowing that I will always come in second place. I love the fact that at least sometimes when I'm in my home, I'm not alone. I don't love the fact that it's not always. I love not having to answer to him. I don't love that he doesn't answer to me. I love the way I feel when I'm with him. I don't love the way I feel when I'm not. When I don't respond, Leo turns away. Then it's not really complicated, he says. That night I sleep like I haven't slept in months. I don't hear my alarm go off, and it isn't until the phone rings that I sit up awake, expecting Leo. After our argument last night, he was polite to me, but the easy camaraderie we'd had disappeared. When he dropped me off at my place, he talked about business and what would happen after he received the FedEx delivery of the photo spread. It's probably better this way, treating him like a colleague and not like a friend. I just don't understand how I can miss something I barely even had. I think I might have dreamed an apology to him. I can't be sure what I'm apologizing for, though. I want to talk about last night, I blurred into the receiver. Me too, Adam says on the other end of the phone. Oh, it's you. You don't sound too thrilled. I've been going crazy all morning trying to find 5 minutes to call you. Who was that guy? You're kidding, right? You couldn't possibly be complaining because I was out with someone else. Look, I know you're angry, and I know you asked for some time apart, but I miss you, Sage. You're the one I want to be with, Adam promises. It's just not as simple as you think. Immediately, I think back to my conversation with Leo. Actually, it is, I say. If you went out with Lou, Leo, whatever, to get my attention, it worked. When can I see you again? How could I have been trying to get your attention when I didn't even know you and your wife would be having date night? I cannot believe Adam's making this about him. But then again, it's always about him. There's a beep on the phone, my other line. I recognize Leo's cell number. I have to go, I tell Adam. But as I hang up, I realize that I've always been the one calling Adam instead of the other way around. Have I suddenly become attractive because I'm not available? And if so, what does that say about my attraction to him? Morning, Leo says. His voice sounds rough around the edges, like he needs a cup of coffee. How did you sleep? I ask. About as well as can be expected when the hotel is filled with preteen girls who are here for a soccer tournament. I have some impressive dark circles under my eyes, but on the bright side, I now know all the words to the new Justin Bieber single. I can only imagine that will come in handy in your line of work. If me singing that stuff doesn't make former war criminals confess, I have no idea what will. He sounds, well, like the way he sounded before we ran into Adam last night. The fact that this makes me unaccountably happy is something I don't understand and don't really want to question. So, according to the desk clerk here at the luxurious courtyard by Marriott, who I think may be violating child labor laws, the FedEx truck shows up shortly before 11, Leo says. What should I do in the meantime? I don't know, Leo replies. Take a shower, paint your nails, read People magazine, rent a chick flick. That's what I'm going to do. My tax dollars are being put to such good use in your salary. Okay, fine, I'll read Us Weekly instead. I laugh. I'm serious. Call your grandma and make sure she's still feeling up to a visit from us. And then,
Well, if you really want to do something, you could go visit Joseph Weber. I feel my breath catch in my throat. Alone? Don't you usually visit him alone? Yes, but it's going to take some time to build our case, Sage, which means that during the process, Joseph has to believe you're still considering doing what he asked you to do. If I hadn't been here today, would you have seen him?
Probably, I admit. But that was before...
My voice trails off. Before you knew he was a Nazi? Or before you understood what that really meant? His voice is sober now, no more joking. If anything, that's exactly why you should keep up pretenses. You know now what's at stake.
What am I supposed to say to him? I ask.
Nothing, Leo advises. Let him talk to you. See if he says something detailed either that matches what your Nana told us or that we can ask her about. It isn't until I've hung up and I'm standing in the shower with the hot water streaming down my back that I realize I have no transportation. My car is still at the service station waiting to be fixed after the accident. It's too far to walk to Joseph's house. I towel off and dry my hair and throw on a pair of shorts and a tank top, even though I would bet $100 that Leo will again be wearing a suit when he shows up. But if, as he said, appearances are part of this game, then I have to wear what I've worn in the past to Joseph's house. In my garage, I find the bike I last used when I was in college. Its tires are flat, but I unearth a hand pump to get them reasonably inflated. Then I quickly whip up a batter in the kitchen and bake streusel muffins. They are still steaming when I wrap them in foil, stick them gently in my backpack, and start pedaling to Joseph's house. As I bike up these New England hills, as my heart races, I think about what my grandmother told me yesterday. I remember the story of Joseph's childhood. They are two speeding trains coming at each other, destined to crash. I am helpless to stop it, yet I cannot turn away. By the time I reach Joseph's house, I am breathing hard and sweating. When he sees me, he frowns, concerned.
You are all right?
That's a loaded question. I rode my bike here. My car's in the shop.
Well, he says, I'm glad to see you.
I wish I could say the same. But now, when I see the lines in Joseph's face, they smooth before my eyes into the stern jaw of the Schutzhaftlagerführer who stole, lied, and murdered. I realize, ironically, that he's gotten what he hoped for. I believe his story. I believe it so much I can barely stand here without being sick. Eva darts out the door and dances around my feet. I brought you something, I say. Reaching into my backpack, I pull out the package of freshly baked muffins.
I think that being your friend is very bad for my waistline, Joseph says.
He invites me into the house. I take my usual seat across from him at the chessboard. He puts up the kettle and returns with coffee for both of us.
Truthfully, I was not sure you would come back, he says. But I told you last time. It was a lot to take in.
You have no idea, I think.
A lot of people, they hear Auschwitz and they immediately assume you are a monster.
His words bring to mind my grandmother's upior. I thought that was what you wanted me to think.
Joseph winces. I wanted you to hate me enough to want to kill me, but I didn't realize how that would make me feel.
You called it the asshole of the world. Joseph takes a shallow breath.
It is my turn, yes?
He leans forward and knocks away one of my pawns with a Pegasus knight. He moves slowly, carefully, an old man. Harmless. I remember my grandmother talking about how his hand shook, and I watch as he lifts my pawn from the inlaid wooden chessboard, but his movements are too unsteady in general for me to be able to tell if he has a particular lasting injury. He waits until my concentration is focused on the board before he begins to speak.
In spite of the reputation Auschwitz has now, I found it was a good assignment. I was safe. I wouldn't be shot by a Russian. There was even a little village in the camp where we would go for our meals and drinks and even concerts. When we were relaxing there, it was almost possible to believe there wasn't a war going on. We? My brother? The one who worked in Section 4? Administration? He was an accountant who added numbers and sent the tallies to the commandant. My rank was much higher than his. Joseph brushes the crumbs from his napkin onto his plate. He reported to me. I touch my finger to a dragon bishop, and Joseph makes a sound low in his throat. No? I ask. He shakes his head. Instead, I place my hand on the broad back of a centaur, the only rook I have left. So you were the head of administration? No. I was in Section 3. I was SS Schutzhaftlagerführer of the women's camp. You were the head honcho at the death factory, I said flatly. Not the boss, Joseph said, but high in the chain of command. And besides, I did not know what was happening at the camp when I first arrived in 1943. You expect me to believe that? I can only tell you what I know. My job wasn't at the gas chambers. I oversaw the prisoners who were kept alive. Did you get to pick and choose? No. I was present when the trains arrived, but that task fell to the camp doctors. Mostly I just walked around. I was an overseer, a presence. A supervisor, I say, the word bitter in my mouth. A manager for the unmanageable. Precisely. I thought you were injured on the front line. I was, but not so badly that I couldn't do this. So you were in charge of the female prisoners? That was left to my subordinate, the SS Aufseherin. Twice a day, she oversaw roll call. Instead of moving my rook, I reach for my white queen, the exquisitely carved mermaid. I know enough about chess to realize that what I'm about to do defies the odds, that of all the pieces to sacrifice, the valuable queen is the last one I should consider. I slide the mermaid to an empty square, knowing full well that it stands in the path of Joseph's Pegasus Knight. He looks up at me. You do not want to do this. I meet his gaze. Guess I figure I'll learn from my mistakes. Joseph captures my queen, as I'm expecting. What did you do? I ask.
At Auschwitz.
I told you. Not really, I say. You told me what you didn't do. Eva lies down at Joseph's feet. You don't need to hear me say it. I just stare at him. I punished those who could not do their work. Because they were starving to death. I did not create the system, Joseph says. You did nothing to stop it either, I point out. What do you want me to tell you? That I am sorry? How am I supposed to forgive you if you're not? I realize I'm shouting. I can't do this, Joseph. Find someone else. Joseph's fist crashes down on the table, making the chess pieces jump. I killed them, yes. Is that what you want to hear? That with my own two hands I murdered? There. That is all you need to know. I was a murderer, and for this I deserve to die. I take a deep breath. Leo will be angry at me, but he of all people should understand how I feel right now, listening to Joseph talk about the joy of officers' meals and cello concerts when my grandmother, at the same time, was licking the ground where soup had spilled. You do not deserve to die, I say tightly. Not on your own terms, anyway, since you didn't give that luxury to anyone else. I hope you die a slow, painful death. No, actually, I hope you live forever, so that what you did eats away at you for a long, long time. I slide my bishop across the board into the position no longer protected by Joseph's knight. Checkmate, I say. And I stand up to leave.
Outside, I straddle my bike and turn back to see him standing at the open door. Sage, please don't. How many times did you hear those words, Joseph? I ask. And how many times did you listen? It isn't until I see Rocco at the espresso machine that I realize how much I've missed working at our daily bread. Do my eyes deceive? He says. Look at what the cat dragged in. One long-lost baker. He comes around the counter to give me a hug, and without even asking, starts to make me a cinnamon latte with soy. It's busier than I remember it being, but then again, at this time of the day, I'm usually on my way home to go to bed. There are mothers in jogging clothes, young men typing furiously on their laptops, a cluster of red hat ladies sharing a single chocolate croissant. That makes me glance at the wall behind the counter, the baskets filled with expertly browned baguettes, buttery brioche, semolina loaves. Is this newfound popularity due to the baker who took over for me? Rocco can read my mind because he nods in the direction of a plastic banner hanging on the wall behind me. Home of the Jesus Loaf. We get foot traffic, but just because you're holy doesn't mean you're hungry, he says. All I pray for now is that you'll come back, or else Mary gets raptured. I laugh. I miss you too, Rocco. Where is the blessed boss anyway? Somewhere in the shrine, crying 'cause Miracle-Gro isn't heaven sent. I pour my latte into the takeaway cup and cut through the kitchen on my way to the shrine. The kitchen is spotless. The containers of poolish and other preferments are organized neatly by date. Different tubs of grains and flowers are labeled and arranged alphabetically. The wooden counter where I shape the dough has been wiped down. The bulk mixer rests like a sleeping dragon in the corner. Whatever Clark has been doing here, he has been doing well. It makes me feel like even more of a loser. If I'd been naive enough to think that our daily bread was nothing without me and my recipes, I now realize that this isn't true. It may be different, but ultimately I'm replaceable. This has always been Mary's dream. I'm just living on the fringes. I walk up the holy stairs to find her kneeling in the monk's hood. She's weeding, wearing rubber gloves pulled high up her arms. I'm glad you came by. I've been thinking about you. How's your head? She glances at the bruise from the car accident, which I've covered with my bangs. I'm fine, I tell her. Rocco says the Jesus loaf is still getting you business. In iambic pentameter, I'm sure. And it seems like Clark's got the baking under control. He does, Mary says bluntly. But like I said the other night, he isn't you. She gets to her feet and gives me a big hug. You sure you're all right? Physically, yes. Emotionally, I don't know, I admit. There's been a little drama with my grandmother. Oh, Sage, I'm sorry. Is there anything I can do? Although the thought of an ex-nun getting involved with a Holocaust survivor and a former Nazi sounds like the punchline to a joke, it's actually what drew me to the bakery today. As a matter of fact, that's why I'm here. Anything, Mary promises. I'll start to say a rosary for your grandma today. That's okay. I mean, you can if you want to, but I was hoping to borrow the kitchen for about an hour. Mary puts her hands on my shoulders. Sage, she says, it's your kitchen. 10 minutes later, I have an oven warming, an apron wrapped around my waist, and I'm up to my elbows in flour. I could have baked at home, true, but the ingredients I needed were here. The sourdough itself would have taken days to prepare. It feels strange to be working with such a tiny amount of dough. It feels even stranger to hear, just outside, the cacophony of the lunchtime crowd coming in. I move around the kitchen, weaving from cabinet to shelf to pantry. I chop and mix bittersweet chocolate and ground cinnamon. I add a hint of vanilla. I create a small cavern as deep as my thumb in the knot of dough and twist its limbs into an ornate crown. I let it proof, and in the meantime, instead of hiding in the back room, I go into the cafe and talk to Rocco. I work the cash register. I chat with customers about the Heat and the Red Sox,
about how pretty Westerbrook is in the summer, not once trying to cover my face with my bangs, and I marvel at how all these people can go about their lives as if they're not sitting on a powder keg, as if they don't know that when you pull back the curtain of an ordinary life, there might be something terrible hidden behind it.
The second time, Alex told me, as I lay beside him after we made love, it was a prostitute who had stopped to pull up her stockings in an alley. It was easier, or so I told myself, because otherwise I would have had to admit that what I'd done before was wrong. The third time, my first man, a banker who was locking up at the end of the day. There was a teenage girl once who was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and a socialite I heard crying on a hotel balcony, and after that I stopped caring who they had been. It only mattered that they were there, at that moment when I needed them. Alexander closed his eyes. It turns out that the more you repeat the same action, no matter how reprehensible, the more you can make an excuse for it in your own mind.
I turned in his arms. How do I know that one day you won't kill me? He stared at me, hesitating.
You don't, he said.
We didn't speak after that. We didn't know that someone was outside listening to everything we had said and to the symphony of our bodies. So while Damien slipped away from where he was eavesdropping and went to the cave to capture a frantic, frightened Casimir, I rose over Alex like a phoenix. I felt him move within me, and I thought of not death, but only resurrection.
Leo. My cell phone rings when I have just spread the photo array from Ginevra across the expanse of the hotel bed. Leo, my mother says, I had a dream about you last night. Really? I say, squinting at Reiner Hartmann. Ginevra used the photograph from his SS file, which is now propped up against a pillow that was decidedly uncomfortable and that has left me with a crick in my neck. I look at the first page of the file, with his personal information and the snapshot in uniform, trying to compare this picture with the one I'm planning to present to Minka. Hartmann Reiner, Westfalenstrasse 1818, 33142, Buren, Wevelsburg, DOB 180420, Blutgruppe AB. You can't see his eyes very well in the photograph. There's a strange shadow in the grain. But the reproduction in the suspect array isn't shoddy as I had first thought. It's just that the original isn't in the best shape.
I was with your son and we were playing at the beach. He kept telling me, Grandma, you have to bury your feet or nothing will grow. So I figured he wants to play a game, fine. And I let him pile the sand up to my ankles and pour water over them from a bucket. And then, guess what?
What?
When I shook off the sand, there were tiny roots growing out of the bottoms of my feet.
I wonder if Minka will not be able to make an ID because of the quality of the photograph. That's fascinating, I say absently.
Leo, you're not listening to me.
I am. You had a dream about me that I wasn't in.
Your son was in it.
I don't have a son.
Ah, you have to remind me. My mother sighs. What do you think it means?
That I'm not married?
No, the dream. The roots growing out of the soles of my feet.
I don't know, Ma, that you're deciduous.
Everything's a joke to you, my mother says, miffed.
I can sense that if I don't take a few minutes to focus on her, I'm going to have to feel the call from my sister, too, telling me that my mom is angry. I push the photographs away. Maybe that's because what I do for a living is so hard to understand. I need a way to let it go at the end of the day. I tell her and I realize that this is true.
You know I'm proud of you, Leo, of what you do.
Thanks.
And you know I worry about you.
Believe me, you make that patently clear.
Which is why I think it's important for you to take a little time to yourself.
I don't like where this is going.
I'm working. You're in New Hampshire.
I scowl at the phone.
I swear to God, I'm hiring you. I think you're a better tracker than anyone I've got in the office. You called to ask your sister for a hotel recommendation, and she told me you were on the road for business.
Nothing sacred.
Anyway, maybe you want to get a massage when you're back at the hotel at the end of the day.
Who is she? I ask wearily.
Rachel Zweig, Lily Zweig's daughter. She's getting a degree in massage therapy in Nashua. You know, the cell phone service really stinks up here, I say, holding the phone away from me at arm's length. I'm losing you. Not only can I track you, I can tell when you're feeding me a load of BS, Leo. I love you, Ma, I laugh. I loved you first, she says. As I gather the photo spread together into its file, I wonder what my mother would make of Sage Singer. She'd love the fact that Sage could keep me well fed, since always I look too skinny to my mother. She would look at her scar and think of her as a survivor. She would appreciate the way Sage still grieves for her own mom and her close attachment to her grandmother, since to my mother, family is the carbon atom at the base of all life forms. On the other hand, my mother has always wanted me to marry someone who is Jewish, and Sage, a self-professed atheist, doesn't qualify. Then again, she has a grandmother who survived the Holocaust, which has to earn her a few points. I break off in my thoughts, wondering why I'm thinking of marrying a woman I met yesterday, one who simply means to a witness for me, and one who clearly, as evidenced by last night, is in love with someone else. Adam. A guy who stood about 6'4" and had shoulders you could use as a Thanksgiving banquet table. Goyisha, my mother would call him, with his sandy hair and aw-shuck smile. Seeing him last night, and watching Sage react as if she'd been electrocuted, brought back every acne-riddled middle school post-traumatic flashback, from the cheerleader who told me I wasn't really her type after I published a sonnet to her in the school literary magazine, to my junior prom date, who started dancing with a soccer jock when I was getting her a cup of punch and wound up going home with him. I've got nothing against Adam, and what Sage wants to do to screw up her life is her own business. I also know that it takes two to make a mistake of that magnitude. But Adam has a wife. The expression on Sage's face when she saw the woman made me want to put my arm around her and tell her she could do so much better than this guy. Like, maybe me. Fine, okay, I have a little bit of a crush on her. Or maybe her baking. Or her husky, raspy, incredibly sexy voice, which she doesn't even realize is sexy. This feeling takes me by surprise. I spend my life hunting down people who want to stay lost, but I have had considerably less luck finding someone I'd like to keep around for a while. Stuffing the file into my briefcase, I shake these thoughts off. Maybe my mother is right and I do need a massage, or whatever form of relaxation it'll take to get me back to separating my work.